This ROFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Hi folks, this is Richard Hall from Stonehenge ITRO, and this of course is our night sky. And I've got Keith Austin with me as well.
Hello folks.
His shirt's a little bit different from the one that you can see up there, but you might... a wide open mouth of a lion, isn't it, on there?
Yeah.
Okay. I always like to thank Dan Broughton, who sponsors this program. And something special about the night sky, of course, we tend to take it for granted, you know. But you've got to remember that we're now a dark sky site out here, International Dark Sky in the Wairarapa. But the vast majority of people never see a night sky like that, over 80%. Right. So it tends to be the things that we tend to take for granted. Anyway, I should also mention that out at Stonehenge, we're open at the moment every day of the week in January, from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock if you want to come out. And of course, these stone circles are intimately linked with the sky, the sun, the moon and the stars and so on.
All the positions of the heavenly bodies, the stars, the sun, the moon, the planets.
I think people often get astounded when they come out there and actually come on one of our tours. Yeah. And the information that you actually get from is like a stone computer. But I know we say if they weren't that clever, we wouldn't be here. But yeah,
it is actually a stone computer.
Yeah,
and it's amazing, and it doesn't need batteries, and it doesn't need an internet connection.
No,
it's astonishing.
And the thing is, and those things are absolutely vital. I think it's because the problem is these days we're not taught this basic information. It's all provided for us.
Yeah.
But once upon a time, you had to be able to find these things out for yourself.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, as well as tours just going round the henge, you can do guided tours when you might end up with someone like me taking you around and telling you all the stories behind it. And in the evening, we often do night sky tours, right? But these have to be booked, all right? And so on. So all you have to do is phone up Stonehenge and make a booking through there, all right? And you should be able to get Kay at the moment because she's holding the fort out there at the moment. Well, in the evening sky, as we look out, you can't have missed it. It was that big, bright star over towards the west. Not a star at all. Of course, it is the planet Venus. All right? And Venus is the brightest star-like object in the sky at certain times of the year.
It's so bright that it's actually, when it's shining in the sky, it's always near the sun. But when it's shining in the morning sky or the evening sky, it's actually the first so-called star to come out. It comes out before any of the proper stars come out.
Mm.
And that's how you can identify that you're looking at Venus.
Yeah, but its brilliance gives the game away. Mm. Right. Anyway, they got Venus in. It was accompanied by Mercury until recently, but there's some other planets in the sky. We'll be talking about those later on. But the big thing that a lot of noise is being made about is that there's a comet in the sky. there is Comet Atlas. All right. Now, that is a photograph of the comet, but that's not a photograph taken together. it's very difficult to see. Astronomers were hoping that this big comet that's gone around the sun would be brightening. But I'm afraid I was trying to go out last night with the unaided eye and I didn't manage to pick it up. Have you picked it up yet?
No, I haven't picked it up yet. Yeah. I'm looking forward to getting a good night sky where I live so I can some good seeing so I can actually see the comet.
Yeah, Comet Atlas, yes. Yeah.
Comet C-2024-G3.
Yeah, also we stick with Atlas, eh?
Yeah, also known as Comet Atlas, yes.
Yeah, okay, so, and of course, comets always bring lots and lots of interest from the public particularly.
Mm.
Well, of course, astronomers also, because they're rather special objects. Here we've got some photographs of this comet in the sky taken from around the world. Look, things that we've measured, it's moving at 57 kilometres per second when this photograph was taken. And they've worked out its orbit is 160,000 years.
Oh,
that's its original orbit, 160,000 years. So if you miss it this time round, you've got to wait for another 160,000 years before you comes back again.
Yes, if humanity is still around by the end, of course.
Well,
yes,
that's right. Yes. So because if we look backwards, for those of you watching this on TV, I've just pulled up the scene of Earth when this comet was last around. Of course, you had woolly mammoths around and things like
dire
that.
Dire wolves and saber-toothed cats and all that sort of thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's the last time that that the comet visited us. Yes.
And the leading people on the planet at that time were the Neanderthal people.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So what's it going to find when it comes back again?
Well, comets often been portrayed as harbingers of doom, and particularly the famous comet of 1066 that appeared just on the eve of the battle in which
was Comet Halley,
yeah, and later Comet Halley, and Harold was defeated, and William the Conqueror took over England, and all that sort of thing. And I think ever since that, comets have been portrayed as harbingers of doom. They're not, of course. I mean, this is pure mythology, but...
Yeah, but it's a good thing to blame, isn't it? Yeah. When things aren't, the battle's not going right, blame it on a comet.
Comet in 2007, Comet McNaught appeared in the sky, and that was a big, bright, naked-eye comet, and I saw it naked-eye, and it was just, with the unaided eye, it was just... It was a beautiful sight.
Yeah, well, Halley was when it came back before.
But shortly after that... Everything went wrong in my life, starting with my losing my job, then my father died, then my mother died, and all this sort of thing. And I still sometimes wonder if there's just a little bit of truth to that absolute balmy mythology.
Yes, but you've got to remember, when you were talking about earlier, like a battle, right?
Yes.
And because so-and-so lost a battle, it was seen as a harbinger of doom. But what about the other side? Didn't they see the comet as a harbinger of good?
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. If it hadn't been for Halley's comet, William the Conqueror would not have conquered England.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So the 160,000 years. So I was hoping to see it, but so far I haven't. I'll be honest with you, I haven't been able to see it yet. You know. Look, here's another lovely photograph taken. I think it's taken from the States. There, it's perihelion. That's when it gets the closest point to the sun. Occurred on Monday, January the 13th. And it got within 13.5 million kilometres of the sun.
Yeah.
Right? Now, that's close. I mean, I know 13.5 million kilometres sounds a lot, but it's a third of the distance between Mercury is from the sun, right?
Yes.
And this is a icy body, so it was just about cooked.
So it was inside the orbit of Mercury.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah, that's right. So, yes, and... its closest approach to the Earth, however, was 146 million kilometres, which is just as well, as far as either concerned. And it's also people talking about it being the green comet.
Yes.
Because both in photographs and some with large telescopes looking at it, it appears to be greenish. This can actually be correct to some degree, because in the material of the comet is what we call diatomic carbon and cyanogen, right?
Yes.
Right.
And when you heat that stuff up, it glows green.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And that's what's happening at the moment. It's a mix of material.
Yes.
Anyway, the other point being made by astronomers that its orbit is 160,000 years, but on its way out, it may, due to the interactions of Jupiter and Saturn and that sort of thing, could extend that to 600,000 years or something like that.
The gravity of Jupiter and Saturn are going to affect its orbit, its trajectory.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's quite a possibility we'll know later. Yes. Yeah, okay.
The thing about comets, briefly, is the size factor. That tail is actually blown out by the so-called solar wind, the particles that's coming off the sun, and that tail can stretch out for millions and millions of kilometres.
That's right, yeah.
And yet the comet nucleus itself, the actual body, the solid body that forms the comet itself, That's only a few kilometres wide.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to look at that now.
Yeah.
So I've got to put up here on the screen, what are comets? Okay. Well, going back, they are just exactly what Keith said. They're little, tiny, small, icy bodies. Lucky 8-10 kilometres in diameter.
Right.
If that, right? And what happens is that they come out from beyond the orbit of Pluto. And we were thinking Pluto is the edge of the solar system. It's not.
Mm.
Pluto is actually part of it. But there is a gigantic belt known as the Kuiper. And it consists of literally millions of icy bodies.
Yes.
And what we believe is that this disk, and it is a disk, just like the Saturn having its disk, as it were, around
its rings, yes.
This is the relics, the bits that were left over from the formation of the planets.
The formation of the solar system.
That's right. Yep. So that's what we call the Kuiper Belt. And most comets we see actually come from there. Well, I've just brought up a diagram showing the Kuiper Belt and the orbits of Neptune and Pluto. You can see how large this Kuiper Belt is. It's absolutely enormous. All right? But that's not the end of it. That flattened disk, the Kuiper Belt, in turn links into a spherical one called the Oort Cloud.
Yes.
Which is also icy body. So this is just a gigantic halo around the sun, which, as we just said, is the...
So there must be billions between the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud.
Oh, yeah.
There must be billions of these tiny little kilometre
And they're
wide.
All in orbits.
Yes.
Orbits that run into millions of years going around the sun.
Going around the sun, yeah.
But they work out the edge of it may extend out from the sun to 50,000 astronomical units. Mm. An astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the sun.
Yes.
But this is almost a light year. 50,000 is almost a light year.
Yeah.
Right? So that's how big. So you begin to see that the solar system is bigger than what you probably thought it was.
Yeah? Indeed.
Filling up a volume about two light years.
Yes.
Okay. But what happens on occasions with all these bodies moving around, you get interactions. All right. And what happens is its orbit would be changed. And then every now and again, one of them gets nudged or something like that gravitationally, and it falls in towards the sun. And as it does so, because it's out there and a great distance, it's freezing cold, the outer layers of the comet material begin to vaporize and form what we call a coma around it, all right?
As it nears the sun, it warms up.
Yeah, yes. And so what was it, a little tiny weeny thing is suddenly expands into this big spherical cloud of gas, which is simply reflecting the light of the sun.
Mm.
And then, of course, as it gets closer to the sun, a tail forms. And what happens is that the solar wind that we were talking about earlier blasts the comet material and forms this tail. All right?
Yes.
But this is an important point. The tail of a comet always points away from the sun.
Not away from the direction it's travelling, but it points away from the sun.
That's right, because when you look at a picture of a comet, like I've got a picture of a comet, which way is it travelling? You immediately think, oh, it must be going from upper right down to lower left. But in actual fact, it could be going in the complete opposite direction.
Yes.
When the comet is falling towards the sun, its tail is behind it. And then it passes around the sun, and as it goes out again, its tail is in front of it. Right?
Yes.
So it's a stream that's pointing away from the sun. But often comets have more than one tail. All right? Two tails are quite common. And these, as you can see in this photograph, they appear to have different colours. And that essentially the blue tail is ionised gas that's been blasted off, while the other, the golden one, is mostly dusty particles and things like that.
Physical
grains.
Dust.
Yeah. Now, one of them always follows the orbit of the sun, right? The orbit of the comet. So as it goes around, the comet, that tail is tending to branch out along that path, while the blue tail always points away from the sun. That's how they get a little bit disconnected on occasions. And here's a beautiful photograph here of a comet, Comet West. And sometimes they can have multiple tails.
Yeah, it's got three tails, that one.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this is because often what you get big eruptions on the core sun, which in turn that forms another tail and so on. Yeah. So when you can see them, at the moment difficult, but Every now and again, we get a mighty comet. When we say mighty, it's just that it gets close to the Earth.
Right? Yes.
And when that happens, you'll see an absolutely awesome object stretching across your night sky. They are absolutely spectacular.
Yes, and you don't need a telescope or binoculars to see
them. And you can understand why our ancestors look, well, boy, what's this? This is something frightening, you know, happening out there. Yeah. Well, as the comet travels around the sun, it leaves material behind it because it's been swept off. You can see that with the tail. That material is still there in the orbit. And every now and again, the Earth travels through the path of a comet. And then we get what we call a meteor storm.
And yes, all those particles from the left over from the tail of the comet.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they all appear to come from the same spot in the sky. Right? So, but these days, of course, after a while, we can predict when these are going to occur because we know we're going to be covering the path of Comet Halley on so-and-so date. And that we can say, well, on this date here, we're going to get a meteor shower. Or sometimes a meteor storm, it's a new one. But you've got to remember, folks, if you want to really see these things, I'm afraid you've got to get up very early because they're going to be occurring in the early hours of the morning. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
And that is simply because, as I've mentioned before, it's like driving a car, right? Well, when you're driving something along, most of the particles are hitting you in the front windscreen. In the early evening, our position on the Earth is behind the direction.
You're looking out the back window of the car.
Only comet meteors we're seeing is those that overtake us and strike us from behind. But then as that turns around, after midnight, we're getting face on to the path of this.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's when you're going to see a lot of meteors. Yeah. Yes. Anyway, well, as you might have guessed, as I just said, going through the path of a comet, every now and again, one of them smacks into the Earth. And these are absolutely almighty objects. You think, oh, well, a cometary body is only about 10 kilometres in diameter, but at the speed at which it's travelling, added together, the energy released on impact can be something in the region of 10,000 times the entire nuclear arsenal of this planet.
Yes.
So there's a pretty big bang.
That's going to have a big effect on the planet when that happens.
But it's not all bad, folks. This is something important to remember. Okay, look, here we've got, I just brought up a photograph of the moon. Look at all those craters all over the moon, yeah? They're all from impacts, mostly from comets. Now, the Earth will be exactly the same and probably have even more because it attracts them better, except that on the moon there's no erosion taking place.
Yes, so the craters
it's
last.
It's frozen in time.
Yes.
Well, on the Earth, of course, a crater is formed and then after a while it just gets eroded away. Right? So the moon's always a good telling point for us, okay? Well, but most importantly, now I believe that the comets are the origin of the oceans that we have here.
They brought water to the
Exactly.
Earth. Yes.
They brought the liquid water. When the Earth was being pummeled, it would be an absolute hell. But the material arriving from those comets formed the oceans.
So it was because of those comets that we have water on the Earth now.
Absolutely.
Including the oceans and thereby life.
Yeah, well, that leads
because
on to the
next question.
Because
where there's water, there's life.
They're also calling them the harbingers of life, because by studying the comets, what they've discovered, there's complex molecules are found on comets. Now, complex molecules aboard a comet can survive impact, according to NASA and the experiments that they've carried out. The impact causes amino acids to join together into peptide chains.
Yes.
It'll photograph that coming up. And peptide chains form polypeptides.
Yes.
So those are very complicated words. And polypeptide chains form proteins. And finally, proteins are the building blocks of life, DNA and RNA.
Yeah.
So when we see a comet, that material that's been swept up is the harbingers of life. Yeah.
Exactly. It's easy to create amino acids. It can be done in the laboratory.
Yeah.
But getting those amino acids to join together to make proteins, is a lot more difficult, and I think we have the comets to thank for starting that process off.
But this is, of course, is important, folks, because what it's also telling us that no matter where you go in the solar system or beyond that to around other stars, where there are obviously the cometary bodies, the basic ingredients of life are falling on a planet. Yes. Now, whether life evolves or not will obviously depend on the end environment. If the planet's too close to its star or too far away, everything gets burnt up or frozen down. But if the conditions are just right, the mass is just right, Hey, you're going to have life out there.
Yeah, so life has got to be pretty much inevitable.
And I think it's a natural part of the universe. Yeah. This is what it's telling us, and that's what we're going to find when we get out there.
So what you're saying, of course, is that other exoplanets around other stars, other suns elsewhere in the galaxy, they have their own comets creating meteor swarms and crashing onto the planets and bringing water and eventually life.
Yeah, yes. That's right. So they were the harbingers of good life and good as well as that. But of course, they are also the harbingers of doom these days, because if a comet strikes the Earth, as I mentioned earlier, it had a catastrophic effect on the Earth. Mm. And it's not just the place where it actually hits, it's the impact it has on the environment, the material that's hurled up. Absolute climatic change occurs. And we now know that mass extinctions, like the disappearance of the dinosaurs, for example, we now know was due to a comet hitting the Earth.
Yeah.
And what happened was something in the region of 80% of all the living things on the planet perished. Mm.
It a comet or a meteorite?
It could be an asteroid, but most likely...
A fragment of a comet.
Most likely is a comet because of the trajectories that they have that pass the orbits and things like that.
Yes.
And, of course, the question is, it's happened before, it will happen again. And so we have to be worried because this would wipe out civilization, wipe us out. But, yes. And NASA is very aware of that, and I'm sure the Russians and the Chinese are as well. And so they're spending a lot of time with spacecraft, space probes and so on, trying to detect comets and the paths of the comets. And the idea is, if we can predict that a comet is going to hit the Earth enough, you know, months and months or a year or two ahead, well, we can go out and do something about it, you know. Nuke it or something like that.
Well, what so, can you do? Yes.
Yeah, so we can nudge it a little bit away from so it doesn't hit the Earth. So, that becomes a real possibility. Yeah. Okay, so when we look up and see the comets, and you're looking at a comet over Stonehenge at the moment, they're both harbingers of doom, but also harbingers of life. So, rather special.
That's the irony of astronomy. So many of these things they create by destroying.
Yeah, yes. That's right, yeah. Anyway, just briefly looking out at our night sky, of course, we're in our summer stars, and the leading constellation, of course, is Orion, which is our sign of summer there. And just below and to the left, we have Matariki, which is roughly at its highest point in the sky.
Yes.
Looking at the seven sisters and so on. But in addition to that, we've got some planets in the sky. Mighty Jupiter is between Matariki and Orion, is another cluster of stars, all right? The Hyades. So you've got the Pleiades and the Hyades. And you can dead easy to pick them out because the brighter stars form a V, which is dead easy to pick.
Yes.
Also next to it is Aldebaran, a bright orange giant star. It's not part of the cluster, it's closer to us, all right? But at the moment, Jupiter is quite close to them, and you can't miss Jupiter because after Venus is set, this is the brightest star-like object in the sky.
And Jupiter, you can tell that you're looking at Jupiter because it's very bright, not as bright as Venus, but it's still very bright. It doesn't twinkle or move or anything like that the way the stars do. And it has a sort of a very slightly yellowish tinge to it.
Yeah.
If you let your eyes darken that for a while, you can see Jupiter has just wonderful sort of a golden white tinge to its light. Yeah. And that's how you know you're looking at
Jupiter. And we were talking earlier about solar systems forming, because you look at Jupiter and it's got something like 40 moons, isn't it? You know what I mean?
I think it's over 60 now.
It probably is.
Yes.
With technology of discovering more and more. So it's like it's a miniature solar system, and with Jupiter at the centre. Mm. So this thing of planetary formation is a common factor when planets on stars form.
You know? Yes.
Yeah. Which is very encouraging when we look out there, you know. But it's not the only one. We've also got Mars in the sky, because just in the northeast there we have the two bright stars of Gemini, Castor and Pollux, the constellation of Gemini. And in there at the moment is Mars. I say at the moment because planets move, particularly Mars, changes its position. So this is what it would be tonight if it's nice and clear.
I tried to see Mars last night, actually, but there's this enormous big gum tree that my neighbours have, and it blocks the view to the east.
I tell you what, folks, you'll actually pick it up. It's called the Red Planet. Even with the unaided eye, you can see it's got a definite orangey-red tinge to it. Right?
Exactly.
And so this is Mars, and we're going to have a close look at Mars and some of the stories behind Mars and what we discovered about it in the next programme. But Mars makes its closest approach to the Earth on January the 15th, right? So it's well about its closest point, and it'll begin to rapidly fade away once you get past what we call opposition, right?
Yes, and opposition is when the two planets are at their closest.
Yeah, opposite the Sun.
And that's when the Martians are going to start sending warships to Earth.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
Exactly.
But the thing is that there's more science fiction stories written about Mars than any other place in the universe.
Yes.
It's absolutely littered with them. And I can remember when I was a kid, you know, seeing what actually got me interested in astronomy was this movie called Invaders from Mars.
Invaders from Mars, yes.
And I have seen it again recently, and it's actually quite dopey.
Yes.
But I tell you what, when I was a little kid and I saw that, it was absolutely terrifying.
Yes.
These things ending up in somebody's back garden underneath the ground.
The Martians in the backyard, and they're gradually taking us over, and this sort of thing.
I know.
Even today, I mean, this has been going on for hundreds of years, the idea of life on Mars, because Mars is such an Earth-like planet. It's only about half the size of Earth, but its characteristics seem so Earth-like. It has seasons. It has summer and winter like we do. It has an axial tilt like we do. You can see polar caps. And every summer, the polar caps diminish, and you see what looks like vegetation growing across the planet. Unfortunately, it's not like that at all.
No.
Mars is dry and dusty.
Next meeting, we'll get the images together and take you through the story of Mars.
And
it is a fascinating story.
Exactly,
Yeah. Okay. Right, so we're getting near to the end of the programme. And I tell you what, we had a beautiful night sky last night. And I don't know where everybody else is listening from here, but I can tell you what, I thought a few days ago I was wondering what ever happened to summer. Yeah.
Summer? What's oh, I remember what that was, yes.
Yeah. Well, suddenly we've got it, and suddenly for the first time we're beginning to get clear night skies, all right?
Yes.
And also the moon is beginning to move away. Last night it was at last quarter.
Yes.
That means if you get out away from the city lights, you're going to have some fabulous night skies. Okay, and also just to remind you again that Stonehenge is open from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock each day in January, and it's the bud for looking at understanding the heavens and things like that.
Exactly, yes. And just a reminder too that February the 28th, we are having a big planetary alignment coming up, February the 28th. We'll talk about that in a future programme.
Yeah, I'll put that together.
That's going to be quite spectacular in the night sky.
And we might have to have some music with this as well, haven't we?
Of course, absolutely. Yes.
Yes, and we're hoping to be able to put on a special evening very soon in Stonehenge, where we've got musicians out there. Beneath the Stars should be absolutely fabulous. Anyway, folks, with that, I'll say good day, and we'll catch you up in a couple of weeks' time. We'll look at things in detail. Okay.